From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process with today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On Story features discussions with screenwriters and filmmakers who use the language of film and television to tell a story. All of our content is recorded live at the Austin Film Festival, in year-round events, and in up-to-the-minute interviews. On this week's episode of On Story, we bring you a look at new independent releases, including Rob Reiner's latest film, LBJ, Greta Gerwig's directorial debut, Lady Bird, and a look at how the classic 1970s action thriller, The Seven Ups, influenced HBO's hit series, The Deuce.
When David and I conceived of The Deuce, one of the first things we said is we want this to look like a film that was shot in that period and was had been lost and was rediscovered.
On Story will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We start this episode of On Story with director Rob Reiner and actor Woody Harrelson on their new film, LBJ. Harrelson portrays the iconic president in the midst of the tumult in the wake of the assassination of JFK and the passage of the historic Civil Rights Act of 1964. I spoke with Harrelson and Reiner ahead of the release of the film last month at a special conversation held at the University of Texas Radio Television Film Department. Clips in this segment copyright Electric Entertainment and Castle Rock Entertainment. Here's the film's director, Rob Reiner.
It came to me, my partners at Castle Rock, Tim White and Trevor White, who had developed it with Joey Hartstone, they said, you want to take a look at this and see if there's something you're interested in. I, at first, was not even wanting to look at it because, for me, you know, as a kid growing up, I was draft age during the Vietnam War. So to me, it was like, LBJ is a bad guy. You know, he's my enemy. I don't want to make a movie about him. But then I thought more about it, and I realized that as I've gotten older, as I've grown up, and I spent a lot of time in politics, and I had actually a job in government in California for 7 years, I started to understand what he was able to accomplish and how extraordinary. And had it not been for Vietnam, would have gone down as one of the great presidents of all time. And when you think about his legislative achievements, it's second to maybe FDR. And I said, let me take a look at this guy and see if there's a broader picture that I can paint of him so that it's not just my image of him and Vietnam. So that's what I decided to look at it and then got into it. And then I call Woody up, and Woody had virtually the same reaction that I had initially.
Now I look at him in a much broader kind of vantage point, and I do know that he did a lot of good things. Legislatively, probably did more than any president except for FDR, and obviously civil rights being key to that. But even the Vietnam War thing, I look at it like, because he inherited the, quote, wise men from Kennedy, you know, the same guys who were telling him to bomb Russia, drop nukes on Russia.
During the Cuban Missile Crisis, yeah.
So I think he had to look at it like, well, it's my fight against communism, the same way his hero FDR was fighting fascism.
Well, so that kind of rolls into a big question about how you look at somebody in a slice of life like that, and also at a certain point in your life, you know, you guys are both over 30. And so,
you mean.
And so the perspective that, you know, a lifetime gives you in looking back at somebody like that who you had a pretty distinct opinion about, and that's changed, like, how has your own life informed how you presented that character and how you developed that character?
Well, like I said, you know, I've spent a lot of time in politics, and I've spent time in government, and I know how things work, and I know how difficult it is to get something done. And what I realized was that here was a man who had a consummate dedication to the understanding of the intersection of politics, policy, and government. And you have to know all three and how they work in order to move an agenda forward. So having gone through some of it, you know, in California, I said, my hat's off to this guy. I mean, he was able to get it all done, and he knew how to do it. Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start. I mean, it's incredible what he was able to accomplish, but it comes from a guy who has the desire, but he knew he had the ability to do this, and he was hoping that people would love him because of what he could do for people. And you gotta respect a guy who, you know, is in public service. I mean, he understands the politics of it. He understood you can't sell the civil rights bill until people are ready to accept it. He did get all that, but he also, underneath, had the feeling of, you know, he's from West Texas, hill country. It was poor. He grew up poor. He taught at schools that were impoverished. He understood poverty, and he understood what you had to do to get legislation. He wanted the Great Society. He declared war on poverty, and you don't do that unless somewhere in your, you know, deep down, you have feelings about that. You don't just go and do all that stuff unless you have feelings. He knew when he went to pass the, because people always ask, did he really feel that way about civil rights? Did he not? This, my take on him was, he didn't think of himself as a Southerner. He thought of himself as a Texan. But he was more than happy to accept the mantle of being a Southerner if it meant he could talk to Southerners and get them to do what he needed them to do. So, you know, he was all those things. And he knew that I'm not going to push this out until it's ready, until it's ready. And so what did he do? Even when he decided to go with it, and he didn't decide until he had a martyr in President Kennedy to help him. As we say in the film, you'll see, he was fighting, you know, the Congress was going to be fighting two presidents now.
Sir, you're going to lose the support of the people who've always had your back. If you aren't successful, you're never going to earn the support of anyone else.
Four other presidents have fought Congress on this and failed.
There will be no compromise. There will be no negotiation, and there will be no failure. This time, Congress is not fighting a president, it's fighting two.
He knew, now I can get it done. But even with that, he said, I'm going to lose the South for a generation. And it turned out to be way more than a generation. And we don't see, we slowly starting to see some Democrats coming back into the South.
I want to talk about two scenes that I just thought were, you know, masterfully done as far as portraying this character who is the bulk of the film. You know, it's not an ensemble, it's mostly you, you know. And there's a great scene where it's with Richard Jenkins, Senator Russell, and they're at the table in a dining room.
Look, what I'm talking about here is freedom. I'm talking about the preservation of a certain way of life, a way of life that you and I both grew up with. There's nothing wrong with that.
Then why are we whispering?
Well, I mean, I think all of us have, like, various personalities, you know. We have the personality that deals with our parents, you know, the personality deals with our best friend. You know, you become different people depending. And I think Johnson really had that in spades. He was, like, very, he could be all kinds of things to all kinds of people, depending on the scenario. And definitely when he's talking to Richard Russell, who's this incredibly powerful senator, the head of the Southern Caucus, he had to be a little more gentle, but a little more bombastic sometimes with people who weren't coming through, who were on his staff. And
he also played to Russell's racism. He you know, made Russell feel like he was one of him, you know. I'm with you on this, you know, I'm with you, and making Russell feel like it was okay to have those racist feelings, which is, you know, crazy. And it's not until the end of the movie that he finally says to Richard Russell, you're a racist, you know. But he's trying to get certain, you know, tease out certain kind of concessions from Russell.
So once you had the script, how did the two of you work together really to develop what parts of LBJ you were going to reveal where, you know, how did you... How did you communicate that to each other about it?
Well, I mean, the reason I wanted Woody to begin with was that he has humanity, you know? I mean, we wanted to show a full, rounded picture of LBJ, and I know Woody, you know, he can play all the strength and the power, but he also has this very soft human side, and I wanted that. And so we knew that there were certain scenes. There's a scene you'll see tonight where he's now become president. President Kennedy's been assassinated, he's taken on the presidency, and he is really having his doubts about whether or not he can actually do this and whether or not the American public is going to accept him. And he walks into the bedroom and he's carrying a drink in one hand and a gallon of ice cream in the other, you know. And he's like basically, you know, sad, and he's with, he gets with his wife, Lady Bird, and you know, he talks about his insecurities and everything, and she's able to, you know, give him the strength to go on. And that's a scene that we worked on over and over and over again. And Woody and Jennifer Jason Leigh, who plays Lady Bird, they contributed, and we all contributed. And the scene that you'll see is, I'm very proud of it, because to me, that's the one scene where you really see who Johnson is, because after that scene, he then kicks into high gear and he gives this great speech to his aides about what he wants to do with the Civil Rights Bill. So watch for that when you see it. That, to me, that's a great turning point for the character, and Woody played it unbelievably well. Here's what's crazy about this. We finished this film long, long before Trump became president, and we had no thought that he would ever, that that would ever happen. And I can tell you, because I've seen this film so many times, I watched it before Trump became president, and then the first time I saw it, after Trump had become president, it was the most bizarre experience I've ever had. This is a film that I've made, and I saw a different movie. I watched a completely different movie without having changed a frame. And, you know, I said, you watch a movie when you're young, when you're kids, and you may have movies that you love, you know, that you've seen right now. And then you wait 20, 30, 40 years, you look at that movie again, and one or two things will happen. Either you'll say, well, it's not really that good. I liked it because I was that age. Or you'll say, I really love this movie now, more than I did even when I first saw it, because now you're bringing your life experience to watching the movie, and you're looking at it through a different prism. So this shift that happened here happened like that. And all of a sudden, the lens from which we're watching this movie completely changes. And things that you see in the movie are taking on different kinds of meaning because of what we see. It's an interesting time we're living in.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We continue our look at new independent film releases on this episode of On Story with actor Greta Gerwig's directorial debut, Lady Bird. Lady Bird stars Saoirse Ronan as the title character Christine Lady Bird McPherson. The film is an instant classic mother-daughter comedy drama that takes us through the familial chaos of adolescence, with a young woman seeking her independence and realizing her sense of home. Lady Bird was the opening night film at the 24th Austin Film Festival. Austin Film Festival senior programmer Liz Mims spoke with Greta Gerwig at the screening at the historic Paramount Theater in Austin, Texas. We open with a clip from the film Copyright Lady Bird, Interactive Corp Films, LLC, and A24.
I want to go where culture is,
but
like
how
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such
or
a
at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire,
well,
where writers live in the
get
woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You can't even pass your driver's test.
Because you wouldn't let me practice
the way
enough.
That you work, or the way that you don't work, you're not even worth state tuition, Christine.
My name is Lady Bird.
Well, actually, it's not, and it's ridiculous.
Call me Lady Bird like
Christine.
You said you would.
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail, and then back to City College, and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Just truly incredible, and I feel so lucky to be starting out the festival with a film like this that sets this tone. And I know there are a lot of people that have questions, so I'm gonna try to not take up a lot of time.
Wait, can I take up just a
yes,
one,
please
one
do.
Bit of time?
Yes.
That I just have to say that my film career, such as it is, started in Austin, Texas, and it started in this room with a movie called Hannah Takes the Stairs, and it feels very full circle to be here tonight, and I just want to say thank you.
Well, we are so thrilled to have you. I know you've probably done a lot of interviews for this, but really and truly, like, to the core, you know, what made you want to tell the story initially?
I wanted to make a movie about home and how home is something that you really only understand and that comes into focus when you're leaving it. And that you can't, when you're in it, there's something about the beauty and the love that's there that you can't really take in. And then as you're walking away, you think, oh, that was it. And then also just the love story at the center of the movie for me about a mother and a daughter, and that incredibly rich, complicated, fraught, loving, crazy relationship that I feel is oddly underrepresented in movies.
Do you feel like you did end up being able to pull a lot of things from your own experience?
Yeah, I'm from Sacramento, and I went to a Catholic girls' school, so just right there. But, I mean, in terms of the character of Lady Bird, in a way, she was in kind of an invention. I mean, I never made anyone call me by a different name. I never dyed my hair bright red. I passed my driver's test on the first time. But I think there was a sort of exploration of certain things that I couldn't express, and so I kind of created this deeply flawed but very brave heroine in Lady Bird. And certainly, you know, I mean, my mother was not like the Marion, but the core of what makes them so close, but what makes it so hard is that they're the same. You know, they're flip sides of the same coin, and you don't fight with anyone like you fight with your family because you've got all the same issues. I certainly gave my mom hell when I was in high school, which I feel just so guilty for now. But, you know, some of it's real, a lot of it's fiction. And as my mom said, after I showed her the movie the first time, and I showed her my mom, my dad, my brother, and my sister, and their spouses, and they loved it. They were crying, and they're very excited. And then my mom said, "Oh, Greta, you wish I'd give you the silent treatment." And I was like, "Oh, fair enough."
Oh, wow. So when you're writing for these characters, in terms of writers that are starting out and kind of trying to structure these characters with these beautiful, elaborate, but, you know, specific arcs, were you thinking about it separately, or were you thinking about it kind of beat by beat? Like, how do you build into that sort of flow?
Well, writing takes me a really long time. I wish it didn't. I'm always so jealous when people say, "Oh, I wrote the script in 2 weeks." Yeah. I think, "Oh, it takes me like 2 years." It takes me a long time because I don't start out with some. I don't know how it's going to turn out when I start. I kind of let the characters talk to me, and I let them develop and talk to each other, and I figure out the story I'm telling through that, and that just takes time. And I think a lot, you know, I've acted a lot, and something people say about acting is that acting is listening, but I think that writing is listening too, that you really have to listen to what are they saying and what are they communicating to you, and so a lot of it is just getting stuff down. I do a combination of like slowing everything down. This is really specific writing stuff, but like often I'll write entire. I need to know how everybody got from location to location, which sounds incredibly boring, except for there might be a scene in there. And it's almost like I have to explore what the entire world of the movie is and then figure out what has the heart of the story.
Were you workshopping on set? Like, were there scenes that you were kind of reworking with your actors, or was it more of a, like, I can sense that this is going the way it needs to go?
No, I didn't change the script at all once I was on set. But that's the way I had kind of, that's how I had learned and how I'd sort of trained in terms of the writing I'd done with Noah Baumbach and the stuff I'd done alone. I don't do any improv. And I think part of, for me as a director, part of what my process is I have to trust the person who wrote this script, who I no longer am. And so I almost try to approach the script as if somebody just handed it to me and was like, figure out how to make this cinematic. I really stick to what the words are. But the part of that is because I take so long.
No, I mean, that makes sense, and kind of feeling things out completely makes sense as well in terms of understanding the flow and taking your time and writing. I'm sure there are plenty of writers here who have taken longer to write something. Am I right? Not 2 weeks? Not 2 weeks. Probably not.
No, I'm literally the only person who takes a long time.
You know, but we do have a lot of writers here. Some of them are new and are approaching this for the first time and maybe have been a lawyer or something else and are moving into this. Is there anything just kind of from your perspective and advice-wise that you would give?
I actually do have... this sounds like this sounds negative, but I don't mean it negative. I would say figure out what you hate. Figure out what you hate. Figure out what you in a movie theater think, if I see another scene like this, I'm gonna rip my hair out. Or if I see another character do this thing, because I do think it gives you a kind of energy, a kind of anger, and a kind of ability to set out your own thing. I mean, figuring out what you love is hard, but maybe it's just because I live in New York now. I just feel like, just go to what you hate. just figure out what you don't like, and then don't do it. It's a much easier thing to identify, I think, sometimes. And I mean, for me, like, with this movie, I mean, something I hate is, I feel like there's lots of coming-of-age movies about young men where the central question is their personhood and owning their personhood. And I feel like there are almost no movies about young women where the central question is their personhood. That might be a question in the movie, but there's always a guy, and there's always one guy, and there's a guy that they should end up with, or, you know, they want to, or they do, or whatever it is. And it sort of creates this value system where the character is only validated through the love of a dude. And I just felt like, well, what if there are two guys and they're both wrong? So...
I mean, this is truly a story you don't see a lot. You know, it's two friends experiencing something together. And when I saw that, I was like, oh my God, no one talks about what these breakups feel like between women. Like, this is something that is just not addressed. And I do feel like you approach it in such a beautiful way. Anyways, let's go ahead and just open this up for questions.
I'm gonna ask a quick question. Like, how hard was the casting, and then did you see the resemblance in the main character?
Between the character and the actor?
And yourself.
And myself. Casting it came together kind of in, you know, a lot of different ways. Like some people auditioned and some people I just offered the role to. I mean, in the particular case of Saoirse Ronan, who plays the Lady Bird, I was casting and she was given the script and she read it and she really responded to it. And we talked and she said, I mean, I know I'm from a tiny town in Ireland halfway across the world, but I'm telling you, this is, I understand this. I know this and I know this story and let's meet. And we met up and we read the entire script out loud. She read all of Lady Bird's lines and I read everybody else's lines. And I knew immediately that she was the person. And I knew because she was great and also because I suddenly started having all these ideas about how I wanted to shoot it. And I mean, Laurie Metcalf, who plays Marion, her mother, she's, you know, they're both my queens. I love them so much. I really knew her from theater in New York and Chicago, the theater she's done more than anything. And I'd seen her do things on stage that I've never seen an actress like her. And so when I was thinking about the character of Marion, I was like, well, I need two actresses who are just heavyweights in their heart. And and she actually said to me that, or I gave her the script, I offered her the role, we talked on the phone, and she said to me, well, you know, right now I have a 17-year-old who's trying to kill me, so I think this is a good moment to do this movie. and she, you know, Tracy Letts, I also knew from theater and his writing and his work, and you know, but like Beanie Feldstein, who plays Julie, just walked in and auditioned, and I fell in love with her. She left the room, and I was like, "Who is that?" And they were like, "That's Beanie Feldstein." And I was like, "We need to get some of that." I love her. So yeah, it's all kinds of ways, and you know, I feel like Lady Bird is really, you know, it was a literary invention for me. And then once Saoirse had it in her grasp, it was a complete character creation for her. It felt like something completely inventive. And she's one of those actresses who can be both completely technical and do an accent and a walk and change her hair and looks different, and yet she never loses the life and the spontaneity. And that's why she's one of the greats.
Okay, let's take one more question over here.
This kind of pertains to how you were talking about how you sort of write the whole world, just kind of like let it unfold and then kind of zoom in on like the parts that like hold the heart, you said. Yeah. The first like three quarters of the film or so were like really like fast paced and frenetic in a way that I honestly like wasn't used to. Like it took any used to. I ended up loving it. But it really just had this like really energetic like feel. Like almost no scene lasted for more than a minute at the beginning. How did that occur? What was the thinking behind it?
Yeah, well, I like films that don't really like explain things. I like films that kind of just jump in and we're like in their lives. And because I feel like in life, families don't really go around explaining how they got to be how they are. You know, you just encounter people in the middle of what they're going through. So in that way, I wanted sort of what I think typically at the beginning of a film, you do a lot of sort of exposition. And I kind of wanted that to be all just unfolding underneath it. And with the pace of the film in the beginning, I wanted to feel like we were tumbling into this life and that we were tumbling into time. It was all very deliberate, like this feeling of that last year, the way time tumbles into itself and it almost speeds up as you go along. And then I also felt like the film, I think, has a catch in the middle. And what I wanted it to feel like was almost like a pop song that you hear and you're singing along to on the radio and it's fast and it's fun. I mean, the best example I actually have of this is the song Hey Ya by Outkast, which everybody loves. And it's like you're singing and you're like, oh, it's so good. And it's like, it's still like the most go-to dance song of all. I mean, that and Michael Jackson. Like, it's just a great song. But if you ever really slow that song down, It's sad. The lyrics are sad. It's a sad song. And I feel like sometimes when someone else covers a song, you suddenly realize how sad it is. And I felt like I wanted the film to have a quality of like, we're bopping along and feeling good, and then you're crying and you don't know why.
You definitely did that.
So that's, yeah, it's on purpose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we can take one more over here. Yeah.
That's awesome. So as someone who is known as an actor first, hopefully we're trending away from this, but... And I don't know to what degree it's about being a woman who is an actor, but have you struggled with trying to, like, grab credibility from the jowls of hell as a writer slash writer-director? Or, and if so, what advice would you have for others who are trying to do the same?
I've been really lucky to work with a lot of people who have... you know, lifted me up and pulled me forward. And I have not encountered a lot of people who've, you know, tried to diminish me in that way. And I think of all, like, the other directors I know and producers I know, when I finished a script and went in to make it, everyone was completely, you know, I talked to so many people and I was using things I'd learned on set. But I also, you know, called up all the people I know who are great directors and said, what you got, what do you have? What do you wish you knew? What are some little things? Certainly there's, you know, I think even when I've written stuff or I've co-written stuff, you know, there's a context in which people will say things like, oh, did you help write it?
Yeah.
I said, no, I co-wrote it. I didn't help to write it. And these sort of like slight feelings of like, oh, you're taking it away a little bit. And I think my advice would be, you know, take up a lot of space. And actually don't feel like anyone's ever going to give you permission to do anything. And I think a lot of women wait for permission. They wait for someone to say, it's time and go ahead. And no one will ever do that. It just never happens. So I think take up space, put your name all over a movie. Just every credit.
Yes, ma'am.
On Story, check your local PBS station for our television show of the same name. Every episode is a surprising and intimate look at filmmaking. Check your local listings, stream from PBS, or go to onstory.tv. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Tremé and The Wire co-creator George Pelicanos spoke with me at a special screening of the classic 70s action film The Seven Ups at the historic Paramount Theater about the atmospheric influences of this era of cinema on his latest HBO series, The Deuce. George Pelicanos is an independent film producer, screenwriter, recipient of numerous international writing awards, and a producer and writer on the HBO series The Wire, Tremé, The Pacific, and The Deuce. He is the author of 20 novels set in and around Washington, D.C. Here's George Pelicanos.
When David and I conceived of The Deuce, one of the first things we said is we want this to look like a film from the early 70s that was shot in that period and had been lost and was rediscovered. And these movies that were time capsule New York films, you know, most of these films, I'm talking about French Connection, Seven Ups, Taken of Pelham 1-2-3, Shaft, you know, Black Caesar, they were shot mostly on locations and not on stages. Taxi Driver, obviously. And they're a time capsule of that era, you know. And as somebody that loved those films when I was growing up, you know, I was in D.C. I grew up in D.C. and I never went anywhere. And we never went on vacation or anything like that. And I was looking at these pictures and it was so exotic to me. And I wanted to grow up and be a filmmaker. And I would always think, well, I'm going to make a movie like that when I grow up. Of course, 40 years later, there's that New York. When I had the opportunity, that New York didn't exist anymore. But these are awesome films, man. And being a car freak myself in that era, you know, where you worked on your own cars and you drove muscle cars and that kind of thing, it was just so much fun to go see a film like this.
Well, some of the films you mentioned had the same person involved, the one that directed this, but didn't actually direct The French Connection, but he produced it, was Philip D'Antoni, right?
Yes,
D'Antoni.
And Bullet,
right.
Which is the holy trinity of car chase films. You know, he produced the first two. He was also second unit director on those, so he knew how to film a chase, a car chase, obviously.
Yeah, and there was a whole lot, you know, when I was in the midst of Googling all the information that's out there on this, a whole lot was written just about where they shot it. You know, clearly the fascination of shooting on some freeway outside of New York. And
yeah, the geography doesn't really work in these films, but you have to surrender to that, I think, you know. How they end up on these highways that are not right there.
But I think one of the things that that did strike me is about this, and one of the things I loved about 70s cinema, and I don't know how generally old the audience is in here, but I had a big crush on Roy Scheider for a number of films he did. So
yeah, he was a cool guy.
Yeah, he was a really cool guy.
this was before Jaws, mm-hmm. and when he you know really exploded, but everybody noticed him in The French Connection, mm-hmm. and he's basically playing the same character. Yeah. It's a lot of these same people were involved in this, Sonny Grosso, and you'll see many of the character actors. You know, Bill Hickman was the driver, mm-hmm. in all of the films, actually. And he was the driver of the Charger and Bullet. He's the driver here. He's a stuntman. He's the premier stunt driver of his generation. And he drove the car that Gene Hackman, Gene Hackman's driving in The French Connection. I will say that having worked on movie sets now for 20-some years, I always end up talking to the stunt people because they're really interesting people. And this subject always comes up. And even though we could probably debate forever about which is the best car chase, and I, you know, to show you what kind of nerd I am, I drive a Bullet Mustang right now. That's my car. But the stuntmen and women all say that this is the greatest car chase ever filmed.
Why?
I think you can see that it's pretty real, and they're not speeding up the camera or anything like that, and they're really going that fast. And one key that I always look at is Richard Lynch, the guy's in the passenger seat. He's really scared. You can just tell. That's not makeup that's making him pale like that. And that's a key. Another thing that comes up often is the cars, because they're not. It's not the first car you'd choose if you were going to get a muscle car from that era. But the Ventura is, as many know, is the sister car to the Chevy Nova. It's the same car. It's built on the same platform. And I actually had a Ventura this year. It's not important why, but I only had it for about 3 months. But that was a 350 square block, and That car was a smoker, man. I mean, it's really fast.
Well, one of the things I think is ironic about these car chase films that everybody talks about is that they have this incredible amount of action and they move very fast in that time period, but the rest of the movie is very languid and slow.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny just because they're always talked about in this way that you think action means quick. And The Deuce, in fact, really took you in slowly to that story. You took a lot of buildup, and it felt like the pacing of this film. And I think, I will say, I won't mention any names, but a couple of the other people that were watching it in the office when I had it on that TV were talking about, wow, that movie was only 100 and something minutes. It was like, it seemed a lot longer. And I was like, well,
it's
that's
a great,
the way.
It's a great point.
Yeah.
If you try to show your son or daughter Bullet today, they're going to be bored to tears, you know? It's very, very slow and methodical until the chase, and then there's an action scene at the end. And I noticed watching this today that the takes are very long. There's not a lot of dialogue. Another thing is that the sequence of that starts with the funeral home, goes to the car wash, and ends with the car chase is an entire act of this film. It's 30 to 40 minutes of, right? Pretty unusual. I think in a lot of ways a picture like this wouldn't get made today.
I can't imagine. But there another thing, when you were talking about, you know, thinking that this New York was exotic, that it really felt even dirtier. And I lived in Philadelphia. I used to go to New York all the time. And I don't remember New York being that gray all the time. And in this film, it really feels like, and in French Connection, you know, it felt that sort of like this overhang of dirt, you know, and smog maybe, I don't know what it was, but it did feel really dirty. I mean, it struck me as being dark and almost purposefully darker.
They use lenses for that. And when we did The Deuce, we did a lot of camera tests and used the same kind of lenses. They have vintage lenses available now that you can. And I think that they purposely shot these movies in the wintertime, because you have all these cool scenes of guys breathing smoke outside, and French Connection was the same thing.
Another question I had about it was really the tension, and especially in the beginning. I mean, I honestly didn't really remember the movie very well, but the first like 15 minutes, especially that scene where they locked the guy, they put the handcuffs on the car doors. Yeah. And I mean, it felt like a horror movie at a certain point, you know, it was really scary. It was the tension they built.
Did you notice the music too?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's discordant, you know, it's Don Ellis, same guy that did French Connection. I only think he did a couple movies, but it's really extraordinary how it matches the what's going on in the character's head, the confusions and so on is in the score. And you're right, it's almost like a horror film.
Yeah, and that was just listening to it back there. I mean, it was one thing watching it the other day that I noticed that, but then literally not seeing the pictures and hearing it from the back, the sound design was extraordinary. I mean, it was really beautiful. And so I think that's something that kind of got lost for a while in filmmaking, you know. It all became big hit music, you know, in a movie, whereas this movie really took advantage of that in the storytelling.
This wasn't a big hit in the theaters, but I'm really excited to be here today, because this is the kind of movie that you want to see with a bunch of people. Like, you know how people clapped when the car Ventura went under the truck and it, all of a sudden it's silent. When this came out and they blow the hood off with the shotgun and he gets back on the highway with that hood off of the car, the people were on their feet in the theater, and you do not get that watching a movie on your laptop, trust me, you know what I mean? I mean, I don't know what's going to happen with movies, but you can't duplicate that experience. I have always been influenced by these films of that era. I think I was so fortunate to grow up in that golden age of when films were so good and you went and talked about them and it was an event and that kind of thing. And those influences that you have when you're a child and a teenager stick with you for the rest of your life. And even in the writing, you know, in the writing of those TV shows I've done, I've always gone back to that that era to try to you know, duplicate it if you can. Very influential.
When you're looking at films from that era we talked about earlier, a lot of them in that zone didn't have a lot of dialogue. They really spent a lot of time building it through the pictures.
Yes.
And in The Deuce, y'all are also, like, it's not as dialogue heavy as a lot of television today. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how do you work that amongst yourself in a writer's room?
David and I both write very heavily. Like, you'll see a lot of scripts, especially Hollywood scripts, with a lot of white space on the page. If you look at one of our scripts, it's written like a book. There's very large paragraphs of description, down to, you know, the kind of shoes that you're wearing, which I noticed as soon as I sat down. I'm an ex-shoe salesman. And, you know, what kind of cars they're driving. It's you know, the pimp's got to be smoking Cools, not Salems, that kind of thing. And it's all very descriptive, because I'm really trying to, you know, when you come at it from a novelist perspective, which I have, I'm still trying to control everything. And that's why you end up producing television, because then you can control the script when it gets to the screen. When we went to do The Deuce, we were tempted to go elsewhere to shoot it, because it just would have been easier and cheaper. Like, for example, we could have gone to Cleveland and doubled it for New York. It's not that hard. It's not as hard as it sounds. And New York of this era doesn't exist anymore anyway. But the one thing that kept us in New York, and the one thing that I do want to point out about this film, is all the character actors in this film, the Italian guys and Joe Spinell and Tony LoBianco and all those guys, you can't find those actors outside of New York. Or those faces. Uh-huh. And that's what convinced us to stay there, because there's always a lot of day players in our shows, meaning people that just are on that episode for one time and they've only got a line of dialogue or something like that. But it's really important that they look like New Yorkers. And if you try to go elsewhere and do that, you're gonna fail. Also, the light is different. Any movie you've ever seen shot in Toronto that's supposed to be in New York, you can tell it's not, because the light is different.
Now you're going to make me start looking at that. Never really thought about that.
And it's not dirty enough. For real.
Well, no, isn't Toronto supposed to be like one of the cleaner cities?
It is clean, yeah. Yeah. When we were shooting The Deuce, we just kept dumping more and more trash on the street. And for real, and it was period newspapers that we had aged and so on. You couldn't put enough trash on the streets to duplicate what it really was, because we were working off a lot of photographs. And books of, you know, pictures of New York and in that era. And it really was that dirty.
We close this episode of On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI with The Wire, Tremé, and The Deuce co-creator George Pelicanos at a special screening of the gritty 1970s car chase classic, The 7-Ups. The film is often considered a part of the holy trinity of car chase films, along with 1971's The French Connection and 1968's Bullet. George Pelicanos and David Simon, who co-created HBO's The Deuce, which takes place around a very seedy Times Square in the early 1970s, cite The 7-Ups as a major influence on the look and style of their show. We go to George Pelicanos discussing some of the mythology behind The French Connection and The 7-Ups, and the prominence of 70s muscle cars in these great films.
Sometimes that stuff gets mythologized too. Like in French Connection, the woman with the baby carriage, they always insisted that she had walked onto the set. I don't believe it, you know, because I know how meticulously these things are blocked out. And obviously those kids in the street were very protected. They wouldn't have, but the same thing with the car door opening when Bonneville hits the car door, and that was all very planned and orchestrated. I don't think there were any accidents on this at all.
Yeah, but how did they do? Did you ever look into how they did that scene when that hood comes off? It's just astounding.
Well, it's blown. It's an explosive device.
So it's just
pre-rigged, yeah.
And it pops, and then
right. There's always been picture car people that are. It's a business. Especially in New York, when we did The Deuce, people would show up with cars every day and try to inject them into our show. That's all they do is they own these old cars and they wait for, you know, they watch the production schedules and they show up with the cars. So I'm like one of the oldest guys on the show. I remember all these cars and they would try to sneak in cars that were like say 73 instead of 71. Mm-hmm. And I would always go down the line and look at them and I'd say, you know, go home. Because they didn't have an opera window in 1971. And then, you know, they wanted to fight with you. Like, yes, they did. And, you know, nope. Take it home. Really focused on the details of that. And we have, every crew has a picture car coordinator that we had a cool young lady named Katie on our show that did a really great job for us, even though she's not from that era. She did a lot of research and she got things like ambulances and cop cars and that sort of thing. They find these things. And down south is the same thing. It's a lot of cars down south because there's more people who are car freaks down there and they keep them in their garages and stuff like that.
One of the other things I thought was really unique about this film is that they set you up to feel like something really big was going to happen. And then sometimes it just didn't. It was definitely one of those really kind of exciting things about the movie because you weren't really ever sure what was going to happen. I mean, I've got to wonder, why did he disappear? What was this movie, you know, in his zeitgeist of, like, yeah, this was the first one he actually wrote, right?
What happened was is these sort of grimy, low-down and dirty New York movies and crime movies in the 70s, Rolling Thunder, all these other films that I like, After Jaws and Star Wars, everything changed. They stopped making this stuff. And it's not to the good either, you know what I mean? Because we lost a lot. And to this day, it's hard to get films like this made because of the comic book phenomenon, which is now overtaken, seems to have overtaken the whole industry.
Brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment of the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing from Brian Ramos and Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more from the Austin Film Festival and Conference each October.
PRI, Public Radio International.